Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Jack D. Forbes. Forbes is professor emeritus and former chair of the Native American Studies program at the University of California at Davis. In the early 1960s, he started Native American Studies programs across the country and founded the Indigenous DQ University in 1971. Forbes is also a poet and author of many books, including his groundbreaking 1978 work, Columbus and Other Cannibals. Cannibals is one of the founding texts of the anti-civilization movement. It explores the history of terrorism, genocide, and exploitation from a Native American perspective. Columbus and Other Cannibals has recently been re-released with updates by Seven Stories Press. I'm talking to Jack D. Forbes by phone from his home in California. Jack D. Forbes, thank you so much for joining us. I want to talk about your book, Columbus and Other Cannibals. It's been an influential book in the anti-civilization movement since it was first published in the late 70s. Tell us about its focus.
Well, it has to do with what I consider to be a cultural disease. Oftentimes we think about physical diseases, but I'm proposing that there has been a very important cultural disease, a disease which I call cannibalism, or in the Cree and Ojibwe languages, the Wetiko disease, which is a disease that causes human beings to consume the lives of each other, sometimes consuming their bodies directly, but more often consuming all of the material conditions that make their lives possible.
Mm-hmm. So you're talking about the environment and animals and almost everything around them.
Well, yes, and specifically as in the slavery days, of course, or in the days of the exploitation of workers, you're talking about literally taking, for example, slaves often lived only to be about 25, 27 years of age. So you might be taking 40 years, literally, off their life in order to enrich yourself.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talk about the development of Wetiko disease. It corresponds with the rise of what Europeans choose to call civilization.
Well, that's often the case because it seems to grow, particularly in the Middle East, and spreads to the Greek and Roman empires. And then spreads out from there, probably also spreads with the Chinese Empire in East Asia as well.
Mm-hmm. Now you don't just focus on violence and aggression in our so-called civilized world in this book. You also offer insights into Native American spiritual philosophies. Talk to us about some of the aspects of spirituality.
Well, Native people generally believe that the earth, of course, is alive, that the universe is alive, the earth is our mother, and most people think of the sun as the father, and although there are a few tribes that see the sun as female, but we believe that the universe is alive and that we are children born of that universe, that we are sustained by Mother Nature, shall we say, or by the Mother Earth, as if living on a garden. We are on a garden, and we have our spiritual relationship with our relatives. All the other living things are our relatives, and we have parents and grandparents in the universe. So Native people feel very, very close, very much at home, with what people call the natural world, which is a strange concept in a way, of course, because everything that we do as human beings is also, of course, coming out of nature.
Mm-hmm.
So we're part of the natural world, the nature world, which gives Indian people their spiritual basis.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think, how do you think this Wetiko disease has been spread and why?
Well, it spread in a very simple ways. It spread by teaching, and the teaching is often done by example. as parent to child. For example, in the Sicilian mafia or the other forms of mafia, parents, particularly, of course, males, teach their progeny, their children, how to be criminals. They teach them an ethic that regards other human beings as essentially suckers, as victims, you know, to be victimized. And they create a view of the world which is essentially the view possessed by a lot of extreme capitalists, and that is that the world is a fang and claw, dog-eat-dog, so-called. Of course, dogs don't eat dogs. Strange expression, isn't
it? It is indeed.
But, they teach that the world is that kind of an ugly place where if you are to succeed, you must take from others. And so that is, of course, taught. And then, of course, it's taught in very formal ways, for example, in economics. It's taught in a lot of economic theory. The whole concept of laissez-faire, you know, economics, is based on the idea, really, that some people are going to be crushed.
And exploited.
And if you don't want to be crushed, you know, you've got to be rough. Or hire people who will be rough.
Yeah,
so, you know, as in the great strike down in Pueblo, Colorado in the early 1900s, you know, when the Rockefeller mills down there were trying to break the backs of the labor people, the working class in the mines and mills around Pueblo, Colorado. It was basically a war in which for capital to be able to make the kind of money that they thought they had a right to make, the workers had to live like dogs. Lived in shacks, lived in tents, poverty, and no schools for their children, you know, no chances to save money and move ahead, but being constantly oppressed. And then when they try to strike and ask for better wages and better working conditions, then, of course, the Rockefeller people bring in the state troopers and the hired guns of private gun outfits.
Now, do you think capitalism in this country has taken cannibalism to great extremes? You think that's the major cause?
Well, capitalism in this country has done that, but not uniformly. In other words, capitalism itself is not necessarily the evil. The evil is the idea that capital is the only thing that counts and that labor does not count. For example, if a guy's got a lot of money and he wants to make more money, he has to hire people to work for him, right? If he couldn't hire people to work for him, his money would be worthless. You know, so capital by itself is absolutely worthless. Unless you are able to employ other human beings to manufacture your cars for you or whatever else you want to do, your capital is just sitting there rotting away like gold hidden in a cave or something, you know? So labor is equally important to capital. You've got to have both labor and capital in order to make money. But so often we have capitalists who become weticos or cannibals who don't want to pay their workers any money. We see this not only going on in the United States, but we see it in India, for example, where you have horrible oppression of the poorest classes of people, just horrible exploitation. And in many other countries, too, where the exploitation of the lower classes, as they're called, the working classes, is just unbelievably bitter and awful. So that literally, of course, the lives are being taken and stolen.
How much do you think religion, organized religion in this country, plays a part in the cannibalism that you speak of in your book?
Well, I think it has played a major part in some particulars because, particularly coming out of the Calvinist tradition, was the idea that visible economic success is a sign of God's favor. So you have this development of the idea coming out of New England particularly that economic success is the indication of spiritual success. And that those who are not economically successful obviously are not on God's favored list.
Mm-hmm.
That, of course, also encourages the idea of not only the acquisition of wealth, but the display of wealth. The display of wealth, not only on Sundays at church, but in between as well, that display is a visible symbol of your godliness or worthiness.
Mm-hmm. You say in your book that most native languages have no word for religion.
Well, that's right, and of course, we don't necessarily have a word for religion either, because we don't really know what the word religion means. But among native people, what it means really is how you live your life every hour of the day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not something you can say, well, I'm a Roman Catholic. No, if you're Bill Smith and you're a Roman Catholic, you have a Bill Smith religion. It's what you do. You can't blame things on the Roman Catholic Church, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You have to say, I'm Bill Smith. What I do is Bill Smith religion.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be judged that way.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you mention in your book that certain fundamentalist Christians pretend that their faith in Jesus Christ as a personal Savior shields them from the consequences of their deeds, and that's exactly what you're talking about.
Right, and, you know, of course, that varies from individual to individual, how confident they feel if they've been saved, if they can go on doing whatever they were doing before. And they're still going to be saved over and over again. You know, I can't speak for those people as to exactly how comfortable they are with their salvation if they continue to serve in the military and kill other people and do other kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They have to answer for that. But anyway, whatever they do, that's their religion. They're not Baptists.
Mm-hmm. So their actions
They're not
speak.
Pentecostals.
Mm-hmm.
They
mm-hmm.
have their own religion, which is their own behavior, 24
mm-hmm.
hours of the day.
Mm-hmm. You also say that an angry, punishing God, which some religions profess, is not an enemy of Satan, but an accomplice. I thought that was an interesting line.
Well, I think so, because the kind of behavior that they've often ascribed to this angry God is behavior that we would find inexcusable in ethical human beings, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Punishments that are not in sync with whatever the person has done.
Mm-hmm.
That's the kind of thing which really identifies the all-angry deity with Satan.
Mm-hmm. So something very interesting that you also say in your book, you say that native peoples are not barbarians. They don't kill for thrills, but that killing is a serious business that requires spiritual preparation. Talk to us about that.
Well, most native people, before they were going to engage in any kind of activity of that kind, had to go through spiritual ceremonies if there was time available. Of course, if they were in their village and they were attacked by enemies, you know, they have to respond immediately. But in any case, after engaging in any kind of violent activity, or for example, hunting even, you have to pray to the game that you've killed. You have to apologize to them for what you've done, because you know when you look down at those eyes of the deer or whatever it might be, you know you've taken a life that is as sacred as yours. And so you have to apologize for it. You have to, in other words, try to make the problems that we have living as human beings as beautiful as one possibly can. And when you come back from war, you have to go through cleansing ceremonies before you can really participate in the community again. Usually warriors had to go through these kind of purification ceremonies, because any warrior is apt to be a little crazy after having been a warrior.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Jack D. Forbes, author of the groundbreaking book Columbus and Other Cannibals. Let's talk about the term terrorism. It's become much more widespread after 9/11 in this country especially. Tell us what your take is on the fact that it seems to have been there all along.
Yes, terrorism is a very old technique for controlling human beings. It was used by many of the empires. When the empires tried to expand their territory, they would, for example, offer a city-state the chance to surrender. And if the city-state surrendered, they would be relatively, you know, not harmed. They'd have to pay taxes and what have you, but they wouldn't be wiped out. But if they resisted, then the entire city might be destroyed, all of the women and children that who were captured would be enslaved. The men would be either killed or sold as slaves. So any kind of resistance meant that you would be totally wiped out. So these systems of terror were used as conscious techniques in order to control other populations. And unfortunately, modern warfare has become a large-scale form of terrorism because the kind of military techniques that are used in modern warfare, such as bombing from the air, destroying whole cities like Nagasaki and Hiroshima, and so on, they are inevitably terroristic.
Mm-hmm. You also talk about that white-only system of segregation in the early part of this last century, and the subjugation of women is a form of terrorism. Talk to us more about that.
Well, yes, the a lot of people don't realize that the so-called slave system, which I call a system of captivity, the captive system in the United States was maintained only by terror. That is, there were armed guards, armed white men who were hired to patrol, and any person who was a captive who tried to seek freedom or who was to try to defend their wife or their husband or their children would be viciously dealt with. They might be killed or they might just simply be whipped into, you know,
submission.
So most people don't realize, they think that the slave system in the United States was just, oh, they just owned black people. No, it wasn't that they owned black people or Indians. It's that it was a system of organized terror to keep other people working for you for nothing. So it's an unbelievably horrible system. And I think that until the United States and the people of the United States really come to grips with how horrible that system was and how inexcusable it was, and we apologize and take care of it, we're always going to be haunted by that in our culture.
Mm-hmm. Before my listeners lose all hope, do you have any ideas on how we can halt this cannibalism that has taken over our world?
Well, I think that change begins with each of us, of course. It's very difficult to change entire societies. I was thinking about this just last night, thinking about talking with you, how the United States has been involved in almost continuous warfare. And we think back to the war against the Filipinos, you know, in 1898 to 1902, horrible war. It lasted longer than that even, against the Filipino people who wanted an independent republic of their own. And the United States under President McKinley, you know, we sent the troops in there, and we wanted to make it into a colony. And so thousands upon thousands of Filipinos were killed, tortured, terrorized, and so on, so the United States could have a colony close to Asia. And it was just a self-serving, you know, stupid, horrible kind of thing. But since that time, you know, we also seized Hawaii about the same time. You know, we seized Puerto Rico. Then after that, we've been invading Haiti, Dominican Republic, Nicaragua, you know, El Salvador, you know, on and on and on, Mexico. And there has hardly been a period in which the United States has not been attacking somebody, clear up to Vietnam and then more recently Iraq and so on. We have this tradition which is built into our culture of being warlike, using violence as an instrument of policy. Well, how do we change that? We have to change it through the hearts and minds of each and every one of us. We have to learn to reject violence, that violence does not bring peace, just like right now the Israeli violence against Gaza is not going to bring peace. I mean, anybody with common sense can see that all it's going to do is to create new hatred against the Israelis on the part of all Arabs, you know?
I was thinking about that, too, and the fact that, you know, no matter how much war one puts upon other people, it doesn't make you safe.
No, it doesn't make you safe. It makes you less safe. But there is a transition period that is very tricky, and that's the one that we have to go through, which is where we as individuals learn to repudiate violence. And that's pretty hard to do when we have a vice president who will go down in Louisiana with a member of the Supreme Court and kill, I think it was 98 ducks in a duck shoot.
Yes, yeah.
You know, I mean, when you have that kind of terrible, violent anger, you know, directed against helpless ducks, which obviously he's not going to eat, when you've got that kind of hatred and just that violent personality built in, it's going to take us a while to change that. But we have to work at it. We have to ask our preachers. We have to ask our religious leaders. We have to ask our spiritual elders. We have to ask all of our people to work together to try to get rid of that violence.
You have a beautiful quote toward the end of your book. It says, "The life of Native American peoples revolves around the concept of the sacredness, beauty, power, and relatedness of all forms of existence."
Right.
That's a very beautiful concept, and I wish we could adopt it sometime.
Well, a lot of people are trying. I think on an upbeat note, we have a lot of younger people as well as older people who are working very, very hard to create better worlds. When you consider that even in the hearts of the most aggressive countries, there usually is a peace movement. In Russia right now, for example, you can see the people that are being arrested and harassed and beat because they want to try to change the nature of the Russian government, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They're willing to sacrifice themselves. And it's true all around the world. Mm-hmm. That there are people who are trying very, very hard to create a better world.
Yeah, but the history in this country makes us pause because many of the leaders who advocated peace, like Martin Luther King, were murdered.
Well, that's a thing that can happen to any of us or can be thrown into prison, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I think one of our Jesuit brothers who poured blood on government documents has been in prison, you know, trying to stop the war machine. So, you know, we have good people in all the different walks of life working to try to make things better. But somehow we have a very hard time reaching the core of the masses, of the population, who are influenced by television, by the violence on television, by the cheap kind of cultural options that are offered on television, trying to get women to be dissatisfied with their bodies, you know, and all this kind of stuff, products to people, sell medical procedures to people because they're dissatisfied with their bodies, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Over and over again, we live in a very ugly society.
Yeah, we do. And we try to make people afraid of their authentic selves.
That's right.
Which is quite disturbing. Now, you were one of the founders of the Native American Studies programs in this country. How do you think that has changed the tone in this country? Has it had an influence?
It hasn't had much effect on the country as a whole because I've been at this now I'm 75 now, and I started writing when I was, you know, about 22. In fact, I was thinking the other day that I wrote an article when I was 22 about the American approach to American history begins in America, which meant that it begins with, of course, Native people.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if we're studying American history, we should always start out with American history as of 30,000 years ago. That's the beginning of America, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Not in Europe. We should not start with Europeans coming across the Atlantic. We should not start with the background for the United States. We should start instead with all the different kinds of Native people in this country, the influences from Mexico coming up from the south, people coming down from the north, some Asian contacts coming across the Pacific, very early contacts, and, of course, influences that might have been coming across the Atlantic, including early contacts that Native Americans had with Europe, and that perhaps Africans had with America. We need to bring people into America from all directions, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's the history of America. But, you know, I've been working at that for 50 years, and I've made no progress. And we've made no progress. Recently, for example, last year, several books were published that referred to Jamestown's founding as the origin of America.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Now, can you imagine that? America's the hemisphere. Now, how did the hemisphere start in Jamestown? The moment you think about it, you realize what ignorance. But what we're dealing with is an ideology. It is an ideology of white supremacy, of Eurocentric supremacy, which is so deeply embedded in this country that our Native American studies programs have not really been able to make a niche in that yet. Mm-hmm. Maybe someday, but mm-hmm. we haven't really been able to do anything about that yet.
Mm-hmm. When Columbus and Other Cannibals came out in the late 70s, what were your hopes for that book and that text?
Well, as a writer, you know, I can't speak for all writers, but myself as a writer, you write because you have something that's been given to you or is within you that you have to get out. You know, you write because it's there to be written, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so you don't really think about, well, how successful is this going to be? Of course, once I got it written, I thought, gee, you know, people are going to be interested in this. And I remember I gave an oral presentation on the wetticocycosis, the cannibal disease, at a meeting of the Southwestern Anthropological Association down in Santa Barbara.
Mm.
And they were not interested at all.
Really?
Not interested at all. No. It just, you know, it's too threatening to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that there is a, you know, a cultural disease that your civilization might be infected with and that you have to face up to that kind of thing, you know, it's hard for people to face. It's just like the economic crisis that's going on right now. What happened on Wall Street? What happened with the banks? What happened with all these people selling mortgages to these people that they didn't need and tricking people into taking all these mortgages and everything? Or the greed of people who tried to take advantage and buy a whole bunch of houses, you know, all that kind of thing. That's a disease.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's not just the mistakes that people made. It's a disease that people have of avarice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think the fact that your book has just come out in a new edition with some additional writings and chapters is absolutely apropos in this cultural moment.
I hope so. But the big question is, will it get reviewed? Mm. You know, will the New York Times book review, will the New York Review of Books, will, you know, these other powerful organs, will they pay any attention to it?
Mm-hmm.
I had a wonderful book that came out in 2007, which you and I should talk about sometime, called The American Discovery of Europe.
Oh, yes. I saw that on your,
yeah,
in your biography.
Yeah, it's about Indians who reached Europe long before Columbus.
Mm-hmm. We will talk about that sometime. But Jack Forbes, we only have about 1 minute left. You ended your book with a beautiful poem called The Universe is Our Holy Book.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me feel like you do have hope.
Yes, I do have hope. Mm-hmm. I do definitely have hope.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have this beautiful universe around us, and we just have to grab a hold of that, you know, and let it fill us with its beauty.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jack D. Forbes, thank you so much for joining us, and I do highly recommend his book. Please go out and read it. It's called Columbus and Other Cannibals. Jack Forbes, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are supported in part by the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes in Corning, New York. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.